welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we have a busy lineup for you today. Coming up in just a bit, our news director Dave Thompson is here with his weekly review of the news. Then we'll hear about an upcoming Fargo Walk to End Alzheimer's, where community members will join the global effort to raise funds and awareness in the fight against Alzheimer's and dementia. And later in the show, we'll remember a North Dakota legend, longtime Grand Forks Herald columnist Marilyn Hagerty, whose down-to-earth food writing made her both a local treasurer and a national sensation. And as Main Street begins today, we're turning our attention to a place that has been a refuge for children in crisis in North Dakota for almost 75 years. Home on the Range, it's a therapeutic working ranch near Sentinel Butte, North Dakota, not far from Beach, has long served some of the most vulnerable youth in our region. Kids who have experienced severe trauma, exploitation, or even trafficking. Now, Home on the Range is planning a $3.2 million expansion of its on-site school, the Badlands Learning Center, which has already shown remarkable success in helping students reclaim both their education and their future. And joining us here today on Main Street is its executive director, Laura Feldman, who has been leading this mission of healing, hope, and transformation. Laura, welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
For listeners, Laura, who aren't familiar, can you start with the story of Home on the Range and how it began and what its mission is today?
Yeah. So Father Cassidy was a priest, and he wanted to do something to help boys who didn't have a home, didn't have a place to go. And so he was gifted this land, and he went to his bishop and said, "This is what I want to do. This is where I'm called. This is who I want to help." And the bishop said, "Okay, you can do that on two conditions. One is that we don't have to give you any money ever. And two is that I get to name it." So he named it after his favorite song. That's how we got to be Home on the Range. And that was in 1950. And so we've had 75 years of helping kids and carrying out Father Cassidy's vision.
What makes this therapeutic working ranch model, if you will, unique compared to other treatment programs? And is it right to call these treatment programs? Is that maybe a misstatement on my part?
No, we are a qualified residential treatment program by North Dakota standards. We do a lot of therapy with the kids, but what makes us unique is that there's a lot of things, but one of the things that makes us unique is that we're actually a working cattle ranch. We've got a herd of cattle, and the kids are involved in feeding buckets and in calving season. If they're lucky, they get to watch a calf be born. If there's a calf that drops in a bad storm, they bring it in and they rub it with the heat lamps and the blow dryers. And it's a very natural feel out here. We have horses and cattle and dogs. We do a lot of animal assisted work. So we got equine therapy and canine therapy that we do with the kids. And I've been fortunate enough to be out here 20 years. And so for about 15 of those years, I was doing equine and canine assisted therapy directly with the kids. And that was just the best job ever. And I can't tell you how many times kids would tell me that working with the animals and doing those experiential kinds of things was therapy without being therapy. And I believe very strongly that's how you got to hook an adolescent kid, because they're not gonna make leaps and bounds under a fluorescent light across from a desk.
Describe for me, Laura, if you will, the profile of the youth you serve and how those needs maybe have evolved or changed even in the time that you've been at Home on the Range.
Yeah, so our kids typically come to us with complex trauma needs. So these are kids who have had a number of traumas that they've experienced and survived. Things that have happened to them, happened around them, or not happened for them. So we're talking physical, sexual abuse would be things that happened to them. Around them would be a parent being incarcerated or an addict. Things that happened or didn't happen for them would be like the neglect, right? So nobody's following up on their education, making sure that they have food or getting their medical needs met. And so there's an assessment that we give called the ACE score, the ACE assessment, and that's about, it stands for Adolescent Childhood Experiences, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And so there's a total of 10 that kids can score. So each trauma that they've experienced accrues in a number. And so from 0 to 10, our girls, I randomly pulled their ACE scores. Average was 8.2 and our boys was 5.2. So when you're talking out of a possible 10, that's significant. You can have 6 or more ACEs. You can plan on their lifespan being shortened 20 years. Yeah, an ACE score of 4 or more, you're twice as likely to have heart disease, cancer, or obesity, 7 times more likely to be an alcoholic, 47 more times to inject street drugs, and 6 times more likely to commit suicide with an ACE of 4 or more. And so when I'm talking...
These are kids that have had a tough, tough time.
Yes, yes, very tough. So they come to us with these complex trauma needs. And, you know, they're with us an average of about 3 to 4 months.
Yeah. How does that shape the care you provide them?
So we do all of our programming really is based on science, right? So the experts in the field would talk about trauma being held in the body, right? So you've got to work with the body to address it. For example, when a youth gets triggered, they're not able to think with the thinking part of their brain. They're just worried about survival. And that trigger could look anything like they didn't get their chips at snack time because the truck didn't come in or something, which to most folks would be no big deal. But to a traumatized youth, that can trigger them like, oh my God, I'm never going to get to eat again. And those were mine. And why aren't these people taking care of me? You know, so it can really trigger a lot of things and cause behavior. But what people miss is that traumatized kids' brains are actually wired differently. And once they get triggered, they can't access the thinking part of their brain. They get stuck in their emotional brain. And so the work that we do is to get kids back in control of their brain and their body. So we do what's called bottom-up programming. And we get kids ready and able to do that more cognitive piece.
I'm surprised, Laura, that the average stay is just 3 to 4 months. But I'm really curious, I'm guessing the immediate crises that kids find themselves in when they first come to you might be different than their longer term care that they receive. So how do you bridge that first week or two with a young person who has had such trauma in their life, bending towards the longer term goals of the program?
Everything at Home on the Range is based on relationship. Right. So our kids have been damaged in relationships, and that's where the healing has to take place. We're all trained in a program called Risking Connections. That's how we connect with our kids. We do a lot of time just being with the kids, right? So our line staff are doing different activities, or, you know, we've got a group of kids that go fishing with Clayton every week, and they love that. Or we've got a group of kids that do crochet with Robin, and they love that. It's all about finding a bridge to connect with that kid. So everyone from line staff to kitchen staff work at doing that every single day.
These are youth from North Dakota and the region, Laura?
Yep. So we do have a contract with Wisconsin, and we do take kids out of Wisconsin also. But that's...
How are they referred to you? How does a North Dakota youth find you, if you will?
So there are only 2 agencies at our level of care, and our kids come from custodial agencies, either the county human service zones or the Division of Juvenile Services. The third way that they can come is through a program called Voluntary Treatment Program. And so there are certain qualifiers that kids need to meet to utilize that program. And that one, parents maintain custody of their youth, but they have to be North Dakota Medicaid eligible, and they have to meet the criteria to be able to come to a QRTP. And if those things are met, then we can take VTP kids also.
You mentioned that Medicaid is one of your funding sources. Gotta ask, have recent challenges to the Medicaid system impacted you and your ability to fiscally plan for the future?
So there's... one thing that's constant in this type of work is change. So with the enactment of Families First Act in 2018, we've experienced lots of change in the system and how kids come to us and how long they get to stay and what that looks like. Our numbers are lower now than what we'd like them to be. And so we're trying to get creative on how we can get those up. But there's always change, there's always flex. And so we're working to roll with what we can, yeah.
We're enjoying our conversation with Laura Feldman. She's the executive director of Home on the Range, a therapeutic working ranch in Sentinel Butte, North Dakota, which is near Beach. Can you share an example story, Laura, without, of course, breaching any privacy, that illustrates the kind of transformation that you see at Home on the Range?
Yeah, gosh. My favorite is when kids call back after they leave. So I was working with a young lady, and we did a lot of work in the barn with the horses. And there was something special about that gal. She worked hard. She really wanted to figure out why her relationships were a struggle for her. And it all stemmed from trauma. And so we did a lot of work in the barn, and she left, and she would email me and call me on occasion. And this young lady ended up going to UND and was enrolled in the social work program. And she called me and she said, "Hey, would you be a job reference for me?" And I said, "Well, yes, but I mean, you know," she said, "Oh, I know. She knows I was there and you were my therapist." I'm like, "Okay." So this gal called for a job reference, and I just talked about how this young lady works so hard and she has a heart of gold. And I said, "I'm not sure what the position is, but if you're looking for somebody who is all heart, then this is your person." And she ended up getting the job, which was working with developmentally disabled people. And she became a shift supervisor and did great.
You've made a decision along the way to open an on-site school. What challenges led to that choice?
You know, our kids historically went to Beach High School public school, and we had an on-site classroom. But with the changes in the system since 2018, our youth are getting, I would say, more and more challenging. Their stays are getting shorter and shorter. And those two things made it really hard for a public school to be effective with our kids. You know, Beach worked hard to work with our kids and get things figured out. But when it comes right down to it, with our kids' average length of stay being 3 months, maybe 4 months, in Beach High School, you had to do a full semester to get any credits. Well, our kids didn't come in May and leave in December. That's just not the timelines for them. And so they just weren't getting credits. About a third of our kids at Beach High were getting credits. And it was kind of a round peg square hole kind of deal. We just knew it wasn't working. And so in November, we came up with this idea and we made a phone call and we opened in June, 7 months later. So
school's called the Badlands Learning Center.
Yes.
And to date, the statistics that I've seen is nearly 95% of students earn course credit. What does that success mean to you and your staff?
You know, it's incredible. We had hoped for success, but we had no idea exactly how successful this was going to be. You know, our kids typically do not have a lot of success in school. They've missed a lot of school. They're not academically gifted, so to say, typically. So we weren't quite sure how it was going to shake. But, you know, as of August 28th, we've served 80 kids. And 196 classes have been offered and 98 credits have been earned. Three kids got their GED and we've awarded certificates. So would we have kids who over Christmas break say, "I'm bored, can we just go back to school?" Like, when does that happen? So the kids enjoy it. To see them light up with some success in an academic area, which is so foreign to them, it's incredible.
So now it's time to expand. That's exciting. Can you walk us through some expansion plans and what spaces and opportunities the project will create?
Yes, we're very excited. So we took the Karis building that we have and we made 4 classrooms, 2 for boys, 2 for girls, by the girls' classroom is divided by a row of bookshelves and the boys by an accordion wall. So neither of those things are very soundproof, or I don't know if anybody has daughters out there, but it's not very drama proof either over a bookshelf. So we intend to...
I'm raising my hand. I remember the daughter days.
Yes, I've got 4. So yeah, okay. A little permanent, you know, wall would be great. But yeah, we plan to add 2 classrooms, a kitchenette so that kids can do independent living skills and do some baking and cooking, not in an industrial kitchen. So that would be nice. We look to add a sensory room, which is designed by our OT to help the kids regulate. And like I mentioned earlier, get back in control of their bodies and mind. We would permanently divide the girls' classroom, take out the bookshelves and add in a permanent wall. And that would give us the 4 classrooms. And it would also give the training space that we used to have. That's now a classroom back.
Where are you in the fundraising process for this? And how can communities or individuals even support the effort?
Yeah, we're about halfway there. We hope to start in January and be completed in December of 26. The funding process has been good. I am overwhelmed by the generosity of people really wanting to see our kids succeed. We've gone to Dunn County commissioners and they've given us $150,000 this year. And they gave us $300,000 last year to help us get us off the ground. McKenzie County commissioners gave us $500,000. And we're waiting to hear back from Stark and Billings. But, you know, the fact that we serve every county in North Dakota, and you know, we work hard to send the kids back in better shape to their families. So it's amazing to me, the generosity that we're seeing.
Gotta ask you about Brutus. Who's Brutus?
Brutus is great. Brutus is like our mascot, I think. He was actually a dog that came through our canine program here. He was a pup that we pulled out of a rescue, and our kids did groups with him, basic socialization and obedience training. And Jeff, our education director, fell in love with Brutus, as we all did. And so he took Brutus home with him. And Brute comes to work every day and hangs out in the classroom and helps regulate the kids and, you know, eats a lot. There's always a snack for Brutus in every office and oftentimes leftover hamburgers. So yeah, he's in good shape.
Besides academics, what other life skills are kids leaving with after their time at the ranch?
Yeah, we do a ton of stuff. We've got independent living programming where we've got people coming out and speaking to the kids, and they're doing activities and learning about banking and college applications and resumes. They went into town to a coffee shop and took in their resume and did a mock interview with the owner. So that was great. We do a lot with the animals, as I've mentioned before. We take rescue dogs and do groups with them. And there's so much, our kids relate so well to the rescue dogs, right? So you're getting this rescue and you're doing all these things to make sure that he's, you know, doing everything he needs to be in a forever home. And, you know, our kids see a lot of themselves in our rescues. And they learn about relationship skills, right? So they learn about consistency. When you're training a dog, right, think of all the things you need: consistency, positive reinforcement, support, and all the things that you need to train a dog, very similar to how kids should be parented, right?
Laura, I've read where you've said, we serve your kids. Mm-hmm. We serve your families. What do you want North Dakotans to understand about why home on the range matters, not just to the kid, but to all of us?
Home on the range matters to all of you, because your neighbor, your daughter, your nephew, they can all be served by us. Trauma doesn't just happen on TV shows and in the movies, right? Sometimes it's quiet. The number of trafficked youth that we have is astounding. And that can happen very quietly. That can happen in your daughter's bedroom online on that phone. So we matter because we can help. We can help all of you.
What are your biggest challenges that you and your staff are up against right now?
The biggest challenges that we face is working within the system to advocate for our kids. And some days that feels like an uphill battle.
As we kind of wrap up our conversation, Laura, when you think about the kids who have walked through your gates and have gone on to thrive, is that what drives you?
Absolutely, 100%. We got to remember our why. The kids that see you at McDonald's and come give you a hug because, oh, remember that time when we played basketball and you stuffed my shot? The kids that call back and say, what you did matters. We just had our 75th anniversary over our Champions Ride Rodeo this summer. And we had three kids come in. One flew in from Arizona and two from Fargo. And they spoke at that gathering. And to hear them say that their time here changed their lives or planted seeds. One of the gals said, I didn't know how to pray until I came here. She's got her master's and is going to law school. The other gal has her master's and is a wonderful parent. We had a gentleman that came back and he said he struggled after because he didn't take the lessons he was taught and he did some time in prison. And now it's coming to fruition for him. He's doing great things. And to hear those kids say those things, that's the why. That's the why we're here.
5 years, 10 years, what's your vision for Home on the Range?
I would love to see us continue to grow in our expertise in working with the trafficked youth, and providing the best services for both boys and girls. I would love to see us be nationally recognized for the work that we do with trafficked youth. I think we're on our way. I would love to see that. I would love to see Home on the Range flourish and be allowed to do what's best for kids.
Enjoyed my conversation with Laura Feldman. She's the executive director of Home on the Range Therapeutic Working Ranch in Sentinel Butte, North Dakota. We've been talking about the transformative impact of their programs and the ambitious expansion of the Badlands Learning Center at Home on the Range. And if you'd like to learn more or support their work, check out their website, hotrnd.com. Laura, congratulations on the work that you do. Best wishes and thanks for joining us.
Thank you much. I appreciate your time.
The Fargo Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 1 from the New World. Performances include Adam Hochstetter's Noir Concerto No. 1 for saxophone and Russ Peterson's Between Two Cultures, September 20th and 21st at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Information at fmsymphony.org.
Still to come on Main Street, a remembrance of a North Dakota legend, and that's longtime Grand Forks Herald columnist Marilyn Hagerty. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
It's time to welcome into the Main Street studio our news director here at Prairie Public for our weekly review of the news. Dave Thompson joins us. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Craig. How are you doing?
Let's get right after it. Blackout plates, they're becoming a thing in North Dakota.
Yeah, interesting how really... It's taken off.
These are license plates.
Yeah, we're talking about the license plates on your car. And basically, they're very popular. Demand has been high ever since the legislature passed the bill in the just completed session to allow them. It's an extra $25 if you want one because it's considered to be kind of a vanity plate. But I'll tell you what, 12,000 plates are out there right now, and the demand keeps coming in. So I think it's going to be the best thing.
Do you have your vanity plate, Dave? Do you have your blackout plate?
Not yet, but I'm thinking about it.
All right, let's move on. The BSC proposes a 350-unit residence hall on campus. This is, of course, Bismarck State College, and suggesting that it'll be built by a private firm. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is this committee of a board of higher education has approved this plan. Apparently, this company called Mystic LLC, which is a division of Bismarck Development Corporation, is going to build this thing, a 350-unit student apartment housing complex with an Italian restaurant going to serve pizzas and also underground parking for cars, which is kind of interesting. When they talked about the underground parking, they said, why? And they said, hey, parking's at a premium at Bismarck State College. So you know, they've got growing enrollment, and right now there's a real need for space there. And the legislature doesn't like to finance residence halls.
I heard you say that, Dave. Why is that?
Because there's been a tradition of having residence halls pay for themselves. So what they do is that you levy money you have on campus and you can make it up because you charge students individually to live in those residence halls.
On a related note, college enrollment, not just at Bismarck State College, but across the state, is going up, and so are other building needs.
That's correct. There's been a lot of talk about things like the higher education funding formula and also to have a separate fund for building maintenance and new buildings. And there's a real issue in the higher education that they have buildings that have deferred maintenance, and now they're starting to crumble, and they need to replace those buildings. So it's going to be a major discussion in the upcoming legislative session.
Air traffic in North Dakota keeps rising and rising and rising. August was no exception.
113,000 passengers in August, which was a record. And what I found very interesting, the flights are 82% full coming out of North Dakota. They've had more flights and more seats, and they've only had 4 cancellations in the month of August. I thought that was
healthy number.
Yeah.
Like that. Dave, oil field, there's an oil field spill that has leaked about 840,000 gallons of oil and a brine mixture. What's the latest there?
Well, they're still cleaning it up, and there's a concern about that because it's an emulsion. It's a mixture of crude oil and produced water that comes out of a well before they're separated. Now, this is also known as salt water or brine. It's a waste byproduct of oil production. Now, it flowed for about 250 yards, but was contained then by construction of a clay berm, and that saved a lot of farmland and also saved some of this contaminated water of getting into water ecosystems, which is a good thing.
And this spill was about 4 miles northwest of Stanley.
Absolutely.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news each and every Thursday on Main Street. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, capturing up to 300 million metric tons of CO2 annually.
Main Street continues on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this Sunday is National Alzheimer's Day. It's part of World Alzheimer's Month, which takes place in September. It's a global effort to raise awareness about Alzheimer's disease and dementia and to support those affected by those conditions. The fight to end Alzheimer's comes to the Fargo-Moorhead community on Saturday, October 4th, as the Alzheimer's Association hosts the Walk to End Alzheimer's at the Lights in West Fargo. The Walk is the world's largest event dedicated to Alzheimer's care, support, and research, with the local goal of raising $170,000. And joining us is Steve Miller, a board member of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association and chair of this year's Fargo Walk. Steve, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks much, Greg. Appreciate it.
Steve, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the walk, would you share your story? It's very personal, and it has everything to do with what you're working to end.
Yeah, Craig. Both of my parents were diagnosed with dementia, my mom about 9 years ago and my dad a couple years after that. They're both still living, still they live in Minneapolis area, but yeah, that's sort of what's been driving me to be so involved with the Alzheimer's Association. Having two parents with dementia, my mom has, it's called frontotemporal dementia, my dad has Alzheimer's, so there's dementia is sort of the canopy over everything, and then there's different types of dementia, like cancer, and then different types of cancer. So they each have a different type of dementia. And with both of them having dementia, it sort of adds another wrinkle to what we're dealing with, because they don't know or don't always remember that the other one has dementia, and they don't realize they do either. So mom's been in a memory care unit for the last couple of years, and dad's in assisted living with memory care likely in his future. But that's what's been driving me to be so involved with the Alzheimer's Association. And then my brother and sister, they're both in Minneapolis. So there's three siblings, three of us. So they're their primary caregivers because they both live within 15, 20 minutes of my parents. I'm 4 hours away doing what I can to help out, you know, remotely. You know, I retired last June, so that's given me some flexibility to get down to Minneapolis and help out. But most of what I'm doing is more remote things, whether it's finances, being a CFO. That's sort of my forte, and my brother and sister are gladly ready to give that up.
You and I were visiting before we started our interview. You don't have to go very far when you're visiting with people to figure out that they likely know someone either in their family or a close friend who's been impacted. This is something that really affects all of us.
Yes. I've had a brother-in-law. He doesn't have dementia, but his girlfriend has dementia. A good friend of ours, she was diagnosed with dementia at the age of 48, which is about 3 years ago. And she had two kids, two boys in high school, one in college, and a husband. And they're trying to figure out, navigate life with a mom that has dementia. And you're raising three kids, husband, you had a job. Now all of a sudden you can't drive, you can't work. So it's the more I'm involved, the more I find people with connections to dementia.
Let's connect the dots then with the work that you do and the upcoming walk October 4th at the Lights in West Fargo. Why is it important for the Alzheimer's Association to raise these funds?
Yeah, so right now it's so different than even 2 years ago, 3 years ago, because now we're in an era where there are treatments. It's not a cure, but there are treatments to slow down the effects of dementia, specifically Alzheimer's. There are two different medications and they're infusions. So it's not just a pill, it's not a shot. You have to go in and there's quite the process to even become eligible. But right now we've seen a lot of progress in the treatment. We call it the era of treatment right now. And there's dollars behind all of that research and funding that needs to happen. So my involvement is, you know, the walks are our biggest fundraiser during the year. And so this is just huge in terms of continuing to advance research and treatments.
How does someone participate in the walk? And what if they can only give a few dollars? How can they feel like they're making a difference?
Yep. So, you know, in terms of the walk, it's free to register and you don't need to fundraise. You can just come and learn more and feel the energy that people have towards Alzheimer's Association and all the different things that we do. But it's free to register. People may raise zero the first year, and all of a sudden they get caught up and they're starting to raise hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. You know, there's just so many ways to participate. Like you can volunteer at the walk, you can walk the walk, you can just enjoy the camaraderie of those that are fighting Alzheimer's.
Steve, earlier this year, you went to the Capitol in Bismarck to share your story with lawmakers. What message did you want them to take away?
It was my first time I've ever done an advocacy type event like this with government situation. And I was a little apprehensive in terms of what it was going to be like, but what it was is we went to the Capitol and we had a table out there. We were the only nonprofit that had a table out there in their hallway there. And it was just we had lunches for all the legislators to stop by and we just talked to them. I told them my story, like I said earlier, about my parents and what, you know, we've been dealing with as a family. And it was more just sharing the story. I don't know the ins and outs of bills and laws and policies like, you know, other people do, but they just wanted, I think there's, I don't know, 20 of us, something like that, that went out there and just shared our personal stories that has an impact on those that are making laws and policies and, you know, and helping fund a lot of the programs and other things that we have going on.
For listeners who may be caring for someone with dementia, might be concerned that that might be in their future. What's a piece of advice that you would like to give to them today?
A big thing is everyone who has dementia, it's different. It's not a, here's what we're going to do to solve your problem. So the Alzheimer's Association is a great, great resource for people to contact when they're just at 3 a.m. and their mom won't go to sleep or is doing whatever, to call and everybody's, the association has helped so many people with that similar issue. You feel like you're on an island, but this, the association is sort of that, you know, place to go when you don't know what to do or you're trying to figure something out. But every person's situation is different and people react differently when they have dementia. Everybody, it's not a specific progress that they're going to do this, this, and this next. So it's just being open to talking to people. And, you know, in the upper Midwest here, we're very tentative in terms of asking for help. And that's a huge thing too, is asking people for help and being specific about what you need help with. Many people will say up here, hey, let me know what you need. I'll help you. But it's when you have that specific need, let those people that have said that say, hey, I could really use your help in getting mom to the doctor appointment. I just need a little break. And I've heard people say, in terms of, you know, being a caregiver, that they say you can't pour from an empty cup. So you need to take care of yourself so that you can take care of your family member that has dementia. So just being as open as you can with other people in terms of, I need some help with dealing with my mom, my dad, my grandma, whoever it might be.
Where can people find more resources, Steve?
So the website is just alz.org, and there's also a 24/7 phone line that people can contact, but it's out on, it's 1-800-272-3900, but it's just making sure you just reach out, and you can call any time of night, any time of day, weekends, holidays, whatever, and you will talk to a person. So it's just reaching out and making sure that you get as much support as you can. It's a difficult journey.
And to learn more about the walk, Steve?
Yeah, it's so the walk is, as you mentioned, Saturday, October 4th. There's a website, just alz.org/walk, and you can search on Fargo. There's Fargo, Bismarck, Minot, Grand Forks, all within North Dakota, but the Fargo one is October 4th.
It's been a pleasure, Steve. Steve Miller is a board member of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association and chair of this year's Fargo Walk. Steve, thank you to you and your colleagues for what you do and best wishes.
Thanks much, Craig. Appreciate it.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we lost a North Dakota legend this week. Marilyn Hagerty, the longtime Grand Forks Herald columnist who became a viral sensation after writing a sincere review of a national chain restaurant, she was a treasure to her many readers who appreciated her down-to-earth takes on food. Eric Dethridge and Tom Russo have this tribute.
I, as a former coastal elite, as my better half would gently rib, felt the tiniest bit of snark when learning of Marilyn Hagerty's viral success thanks to the sharing of her wholesome Olive Garden review in 2012, which got nearly a million reads. She appeared with Dave Letterman, as she did on several other high-profile programs. Piers Morgan even came to Grand Forks to interview her. It was endearing and maybe to me just a little precious, but hey, what did I know? A lot less than Anthony Bourdain, that's for sure. The late TV food adventurer rushed to Marilyn's defense when some people laughed at Marilyn's supposed naivete when in the column she talked about Tuscan art on the walls, the same ones that appear in any Olive Garden anywhere USA. Bourdain said, quote, very much enjoying watching the internet sensation Marilyn Hagerty triumph over the snarkologists, myself included, end quote. He later penned a foreword in her book. But as my better half also pointed out, the Olive Garden was a big deal in Grand Forks back then, and Marilyn served her readers well with descriptions of things that must have felt kind of exotic at the time, like endless salads and breadsticks. Marilyn made several appearances on The Great American Folk Show with Tom Brousseau. Tom grew up with her. She was sweet, witty, and endearing as she was in her columns. Tom got her to read one of them about a fast food joint that we all probably get a craving for now and then.
One question I am often asked is what influences me? And I'm influenced by a lot of things. Items for me, such as watches and bracelets and little beaded necklaces, they carry magical powers, especially when they're given to me as a gift, and I try to take care of the things that take care of me and make me better. And with that in mind, let me tell you about Marilyn Haggerty. I've known her all of my life. She's a columnist here in Grand Forks, North Dakota, at the Grand Forks Herald. So part of the town's fabric that if you live here, you call her your friend. And Marilyn's got over 50,000 of them. Well, when I was living in Los Angeles, California, my father, Jim, sent me her book when it came out, Grand Forks, A History of American Dining in 128 Reviews. And I took it with me on tour in 2014. And while it's a compilation of her food reviews, I've come to regard it as a compilation of poetry. I read an entry every day on the road in 2014, and I've since reread it many times. People who write like Marilyn Haggerty is what influences me. It's original. There's voice, brevity, and depth. Makes me think that I too can find my own way in writing. I met up with Marilyn Haggerty in Grand Forks, North Dakota in 2019 at her house, where she doesn't live there anymore, on Cottonwood, to record her reading three entries from Grand Forks, A History of American Dining in 128 Reviews. On the show in the past, we've aired two of those recordings, Dell's Cafe and Bonzer's. And this one's the third one. It's called Taco Bell. Here's Marilyn Haggerty.
Taco Bell is like a cool pastel oasis on a hot day, August 2nd, 1989. It looked like a traffic accident waiting to happen. There were too many cars around and too many people standing in line the first time we went over to check out the new Taco Bell on South Washington Street. It opened in June and I waited until things sort of shook down. Now it's a relatively easy to get into Taco Bell. From the parking lot, you notice the sign, 49 cents original tacos every day. You see an ad for a free Batman cup with the purchase of a 32-ounce drink. The menu board lists tacos and tostados, fajitas, burritos, and enchiladas. Then there are specialties such as the taco salad, $3.19, nachos Bel Grande, $2.09, Mexican pizza, $1.99, kids' fiesta meal, $1.69, and Mexi melt for 99 cents. The first time I ate at Taco Bell, I had a taco light for $1.49. and a cheese tostada, 79 cents. I was with Barbara Lander and her granddaughter. We agreed the restaurant seems like a cool oasis on a hot day. It's decorated in soft pastel tones of peach, lavender, blues, and greens. There are artificial cactus and desert flowers and a nice tile floor to carry out the Mexican theme. On my second visit with Constant Companion, I asked for the chicken fajita, $1.49, and a bean burrito, 79 cents. I like the fajita and burrito combination better than the taco and cheese tostada. It was more substantial. I have yet to try the Mexican pizza, but I intend to do that on the recommendation of Marlo Gady, She was eating one of them the first time I stopped in Taco Bell, and she said it was great. Taco Bell will have a grand opening later on this month when the drapes are installed. John Cerati, Director of Franchise Operations, is quick to tell you that Taco Bell no longer uses coconut oil for frying. The organization switched to corn oil 18 months ago. He boasts of the real sour cream used at Taco Bell. He said the restaurant canned the ranch-style dressing that used to add 500 calories to its salads for every 3 ounces used. And he says the restaurants no longer use yellow dye 5.
Marilyn Haggerty passed away at the age of 99, a true Grand Forks and North Dakota legend. And it was pointed out she died on the same day as Robert Redford. So there's Marilyn hobnobbing once again with the stars.
That was Eric Dethridge, Tom Rousseau, and the voice of the late, great Marilyn Haggerty reading her review of Taco Bell. Marilyn appeared several times over the years on the Great American Folk Show, including the first one 5 years ago when she read her take on Bonzers in downtown Grand Forks. Tom was a great friend of Marilyn's, and he promises a thorough tribute on a Great American Folk Show in the near future.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 18th. In November of 1879, the Army established a military post on the west bank of the Little Missouri River. The post became a welcome bit of civilization for hunters and trappers. Civilians added a saloon, a general store, a boarding house, and the Pyramid Park Hotel, which was nowhere near as grand as its name. The military post was abandoned in 1883. The ramshackle buildings were refurbished, and the town of Little Missouri was touted as a tourist resort. The Northern Pacific Railroad promoted the area, using brochures and newspaper articles to attract hunters, tourists, and ranchers. By this date in 1883, Little Missouri began to resemble a real town. The Dickinson Press described it as one of the most prosperous and rapidly growing towns along the line of the Northern Pacific. In September of 1883, Little Missouri hosted 3 presidents, one past, one present, and one future. Former President Ulysses S. Grant passed through on his way to celebrate the completion of the Intercontinental Railroad. President Chester A. Arthur stopped on his way home from a visit to Yellowstone National Park. And in the middle of the night, on September 8th, a young man by the name of Theodore Roosevelt stepped off the train, arriving for a hunting trip. Teddy Roosevelt was not as impressed with Little Missouri as the brochures had suggested. He described it as a handful of ramshackle shanties. Also in 1883, the Marquis de Moors, a French aristocrat, arrived with plans to invest in the cattle industry. He intended to build a slaughterhouse and packing plant so he could butcher his own cattle and ship the meat east in refrigerated rail cars. The citizens of Little Missouri were skeptical. They didn't want to do business with the crazy Frenchman. So de Moors simply went across the river, built a new town, and named it Medora after his wife. In less than a year, Medora had 84 buildings, including saloons, hotels, and a newspaper. The railroad moved its depot to Medora, and many Little Missouri businesses relocated. As Medora thrived, the town across the river faded and became known as Little Missouri. The harsh winter of 1886 killed off the local cattle industry, and Medora became nearly a ghost town. It wasn't until the 1960s that Medora became a tourist destination again, and it's still thriving today. Little Missouri, on the other hand, faded away, remembered now only by a single historical marker. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. And Jeremy asks the question, what's being lost in education in the digital age? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Plato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend. And we look forward to seeing you again on Monday, right back here on Main Street.